political commentator and investigative journalist. You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks, welcome. We're in hour number two of this live broadcast. Thank you for coming once again. Thank you to everybody in the TNT chat room. Great to see you guys in there. Great to see the numbers building up, especially the UK numbers. Glad to see that we're a fixture in your evenings in the United Kingdom. Just testimony to the great audience that we've built up over the last couple of years on this show. The fact that they will migrate to a new time zone for this program. Fantastic. I love you guys. You guys have been brilliant from the beginning and continue to be the most amazing and well-informed audience in radio and now TV as well. Listen, folks, great segment by Freddie Ponton. Of course, the analysis is spot on. Freddie's been right about so many things. That's why we bring him on regularly to get up to date on the really important issues. We've got another great analyst waiting in the wings. Hopefully we'll connect shortly. His name is Larry Johnson. He's a former CIA operative, is also a very adept geopolitical analyst, as well as one of the best military analysts around. And we're going to put his knowledge to the test to find out just how risky, how dangerous is this standoff right now between NATO and Russia as people are throwing nuclear threats back and forth. Is this where we want to be? Certainly not. But what are the real risks? That's what we want to find out. We'll do that in a couple of minutes. Now, as you know, the situation is getting absolutely horrible right now with the Rafah invasion and bombing by the Israelis. We have to remind people that the people were pushed into that area, into this massive refugee camp there at the Rafah border crossing by the Israelis who wanted to empty out northern Gaza, supposedly for their, quote, security imperative. And now look at, as the people have been pushed into this small area, these are the poorest, most vulnerable people right now on the planet. What does Israel do? It starts bombing them. It starts bombing them, starts pushing tanks in, starts shooting people, starts killing more civilians, more women, more children. Where is the outrage from the world? Maybe there's just fatigue on this conflict. We don't know, but it's just absolutely beyond the pale what's going on. If this isn't a perfect example of ethnic cleansing and an ongoing genocide happening right before our eyes in real time for the whole world to see, while most of the world, especially the so-called international community, the G7 nations, stand back and watch the abject horror and can do nothing but send more bombs, more munitions, more satellite recon support, more drones for the Israelis to carry on and do this dirty, dirty deed. Okay. History will look back, and not favorably, unfortunately, on the role the United States has played, as well as its allies, Britain and Germany and others. All these countries have been all in for the genocide, all in for ethnic cleansing, all in for some of the most egregious war crimes that everyone's seen in the modern era. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the state of affairs. We got a clip here. This is important that people see. We got this straight off the wires. This is reposted on my X account. This is a bombing by the Israelis of civilians in Rafah. Look how vulnerable the people are there, and what is powerful military, armed and funded by the U.S., basically raining down JDAM bombs on these people. Let's go ahead and roll this clip. So look, people in America are going into meltdown. They say, oh, they feel unsafe because of these protesters on campus. Well, how unsafe would you feel if you've got F-16s dropping 250 or 500-pound bombs on apartment blocks and wiping out whole families with absolutely impunity? The Israelis don't care. They don't care. They haven't cared from the beginning of this conflict, and they continue to go on their rampage. So that is no services, no hospitals in Gaza, no proper civil defense, all of these things that normal cities have, that normal communities have. Most of it has been destroyed by the Israelis systematically, leaving people even more vulnerable than ever. It's so bad. And we spoke to one of our guests, I think it was last week, saying that, you know, without a lack of proper medical care, even something small, like a child stepping on a rusty nail and getting tetanus or something like this, without the proper care, that little infection can become something that could end up killing someone. They could end up losing a foot. All these things we take for granted in our medical care system in the West. Just think of the smallest, most trivial accidents that if you don't have proper care in due course, that could become a much worse condition, in some cases fatal. That's what these people are facing, hundreds of thousands, millions of people in Gaza, because the Israelis have systematically destroyed all of that infrastructure. So, I mean, ladies and gentlemen, I don't have to go into the details. I think it's important, though, to remind people of the severity of the situation and the fact that if this is not resolved in a decent amount of time, we're going to continue to see the excess deaths piling up, the deaths of despair, the lack of medical care, and all these things that, again, that we take for granted or other countries take for granted. And the Palestinians don't have access to any of that, and they're being attacked by a U.S.-backed military as a result. We're talking about civilians here. It's not, quote, Hamas. It's not Hamas. No, these are people. These are real people that are being attacked, that are being targeted here. So I don't know what more to say. I'm sure you guys know the score, our audience. It's important that you keep sharing the content, keep talking about it, support anybody that's raising awareness on this issue, because this says a lot about who we are as a society, as a Western civilization. This has been allowed to go on for 7 months. I'm contending that this is a total failure of Western civilization, modern Western civilization. If you can't stop an ongoing real-time genocide being live-streamed on your phone after 7 months, then I think the society, the civilization, the system has failed miserably, fatally, in fact. So that's our verdict on this issue. Anyway, what we're going to do right now is probably take a break, and we're going to try to connect our guest, Larry Johnson, former CIA operative, also a great military analyst, to break down the threats and the risks of what we're seeing right now as the confrontation between Russia and NATO reaches a fever pitch. We're talking about nuclear drills now, tactical nuclear weapons. How long do we see these weapons deployed in the field? And is that a road that we want to go down in the 21st century, honestly? I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I hope others agree. But anyway, we'll talk to Larry about it on the other side. I'm Patrick Henningsen. This is TNT, today's news talk. We'll be right back.
TNT's James Freeman.
Nelson Mandela said to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. The truth is, too many people have taken their eyes off the ball over the past 50 years. Too many good people have lived in the hope that electing members of parliament to take care of things for us every 5 years will keep things on the straight and narrow. The result of this is that we have allowed too much power to be concentrated in the hands of too few.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Ladies and gentlemen,
today's news talk.
News and information.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. We're now on number two of this live broadcast. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Big thank you to everybody in the TNT chat community. Great to see you guys piling in there. That is the red bubble, lower right-hand corner, TNTradio.live. You can also access it by the app, which you can download on Google Play or the Apple Store. Just go to the chat feature there. It'll take you straight in there. Open up a browser and you're in, and you can stay logged in for the whole week. So great to see you guys in there. Now we're going to pivot back to this this theater that's becoming more and more fraught with provocations and threats, and more disturbing. In fact, the rhetoric has certainly escalated. We're talking about NATO versus Russia. The pitch is Ukraine. That's the pitch where they're having this proxy war. I want to bring on to the stage right now a former CIA operative, also a fantastic military analyst and a geopolitical analyst to boot, Larry Johnson, joining us right now from the United States. Larry, how are you?
Hey, great, Patrick. Good to be with you again.
It's great to be with you. I wish we could talk about more pleasant news, Larry, but this is happening, unfortunately. We need to talk about it. The nuclear escalation, the war of the words, is materializing into more than just words. We looked at the comments by David Cameron. I know you've commented on other programs. Lord Cameron, the foreign secretary, saying with enthusiasm that scalp and storm shadow missiles and things like this can be used to hit Russia deep inside Russia, Russian targets. So Russia didn't take too kindly to this. The French and the British ambassadors were summoned. And very interesting, the statement by the French ambassador after he left that meeting, Larry, basically saying, confirming there will be no French troops on the ground in Ukraine. I mean, what do you make of this scene right now? How dangerous is this place where we've arrived at?
Russia has drawn a red line very clearly in the sand. They're saying, okay, guys, putting you on notice. You know, there's a saying in Spanish, the fish dies by its mouth. And the Brits and the French are busy dying by their mouth. So Cameron started it off with that nonsense, that you're encouraging Ukrainians to use British missiles to hit inside Russia. Well, within 24 hours, foreign ministry was calling up AP, who had first reported the story, and said, please unpublish that. We don't want to say that. No, he didn't mean it. He was recorded saying that, but no, he didn't really mean it. You know, maybe he was sharing some of Zelensky's cocaine. Maybe that's what led him to do it. You know, there's always that possibility. But then that was followed by, within a day, with these reports that were put out. Steve Bryan reported on it, and he based it on multiple sources. I know Steve, he's a longtime Defense Department, served in the Reagan Defense Department way back. So he's an old guy like me, even older. He reported that there were French legionnaires on the ground in Ukraine. So at that point, the Russians did two things. They first called the ambassadors in and gave them, I think it'd be appropriately called a tongue lashing. Let them, put them on notice. And the message was real simple. If you do this, and if you launch attacks with your weaponry, if attacks are launched with your weaponry on our territory, we're going to come after you, and we'll come after you in your country. Do you understand? Oh, boy. That was a wake-up call. So, as you said, the French ambassador comes out of the meeting and immediately retreats on the legionnaires in Ukraine, but as well as the French foreign ministry. Within a half hour of that meeting, they put out the same word. So, none of these people want to do that. And then at the same time, the Russians announced that they were going to conduct exercises with tactical nuclear weapons. So let me explain what that means. I've been involved with writing and executing military exercises since 1994. I was involved with them prior to that, but actual scripting and execution, I got well over 23 years of experience. So when these exercises usually start, you start planning for them 12 months to 18 months out, sometimes 24 months. So it's not like that the Russians woke up on Monday morning and go, by God, we're going to have us an exercise. That's not how it works. There are two possibilities. Either they already had this in the pipeline and they were just waiting for the right moment to announce it, or they decided, these guys are escalating. We're going to conduct this exercise. We're going to start the planning process now. And they're not going to conduct it imminently, but to put the West on notice, they will conduct it. And an exercise, what does that mean? Well, the exercise, you start with a precipitating incident, something that triggers or will trigger the decision-making response within the Russian chain of command, both from Putin down through the military. And you know, they get news. Hey, the Brits have just launched four Storm Shadow missiles that have hit inside a Moscow suburb and have killed 100 people. So that would be the precipitating incident. So then the, you know, their national security structure, however it's set up, that convenes, they make a decision. Yeah, we're going to respond. We're going to retaliate. They task the Minister of Defense to come up with what are our targets? What do you recommend? The Minister of Defense and with the Chief of Staff of the Army or the military, they come up with a recommended course of action that we got these targets. And then they'll have to prepare a full-up briefing of, okay, if we pursue this course of action, what are the likely consequences, responses? What will be the damage done? What would be the likely response of the British and or French, depending on who we're hitting? So, I mean, it gets that detail. And then when it comes time to launch it, you go through just on a notional basis, you do those phone calls, but the staff officers actually have to do the planning. They have to dig in, they have to write up, and so they come up with courses of action. And then at that point, it is up to, I'm sure in Russia, for President Putin to issue, okay, do it, go, launch. And they carry it out. So that's what, you know, that's what they're talking about doing. They're going to conduct an exercise that will be that involved, that comprehensive, that will be then used for going after British targets outside of Ukraine.
And how would the delivery be on this? I mean, explain to us what you consider to be tactical nuclear weapons. They can be deployed maybe multiple ways, cruise missiles, Iskander missiles. How would Russia be using these?
Yeah, I'm not sure which of the particular missile systems that Russia has would carry the warhead. The warhead would be roughly about twice the size of the bombs that blew up in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So those are big bombs.
That's the tactical nuke. So it is quite substantial.
Oh yeah, it's big. I mean, it could cause massive damage. It's not like a thermonuclear weapon or the other. They got some, you know, the intercontinental ballistic missile types. So this is designed to be a confined area in the battlefield. You know, it's like you took out a lot of the city of Nagasaki, a lot of the city of Hiroshima, but there were still suburbs around. There were still some buildings standing, so it wasn't complete wipeout. But, you know, it's still a big weapon. Now, Russia's only going to do that as a course of last resort. That's number one. But they've been pushed to this by the rhetoric of the West. And the reason the West rhetoric is growing so heated, they see Ukraine is going down. It's like that game Jenga, the tower where you got all these sticks that are in it, and then you pull one out to see if the tower falls. You keep pulling it out until the tower collapses. That's what's underway here. I think it's we're not sure which push the Russians will make in the next 3 to 5 to 8 weeks, but one of those pushes is going to force a rapid collapse of the Ukrainian army, Ukrainian front. It'll come quick. It'll be like as devastating as what happened when the U.S. Personnel fled Saigon in April 1975, or when the Americans tried to get out of Afghanistan 3 years ago in August. So it's coming quicker than anyone expected. I expected it. Scott Ritter expected it. Doug McGregor anticipated it. You know, there are others, but you know, the mainstream, the so-called experts, they were predicting stalemate. Oh yeah, we're stalemate. This is gonna go on for years. That's ridiculous.
So when NATO deployed, they announced, they telegraphed, I think it was the British as well as the Americans, that they're going to be sending in depleted uranium munitions. That triggered a Russian response immediately saying, we're going to deploy tactical nukes in Belarus, neighboring in Ukraine. So a strategic move, but a deterrence move by Moscow, clearly. But it does show a pattern, is that when NATO escalates, Moscow reciprocates in kind.
They don't hesitate. In fact, I forgot to mention also the other thing that happened on Monday. The Russians put the West on notice. If you deploy F-16 jets to Ukraine, we believe that they are capable of carrying nuclear weapons and we will attack them. And if they are flying into Ukraine from outside, we will attack there. We're not going to allow a nuclear capable weapon to come near our borders. Understand that. You know, again, very clear message. They're not screwing around. This is not a bunch of drunk frat boys playing poker or just shooting off their mouths. The Russians are deadly serious with this. And I only hope that the Western leaders are, you know, keen in on that. I don't think Biden is. Hell, Biden doesn't know where he is half the time.
So F-16s.
Yeah.
It's my understanding. I might be wrong on this. You probably know maybe more than I do, Larry, because you've studied this over the course of this conflict. But those planes are safely parked, many of them in Poland. This is where the training's happening. So they would deploy them from Poland with the cruise missiles, you know, duck into Ukrainian airspace and then duck back to evade Russian air defense and so forth. Is that more or less the game plan of NATO? Because obviously you can't park a fleet of these in Ukraine. They won't last on the tarmac more than maybe a week or so. So that drags Poland, doesn't it, kind of into the frame here?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at it, so I don't know one way or the other to confirm it. If you've seen it, I'll take your word for it, but that Poland has F-16s. Because Russia's made it very clear. They view the F-16 as a platform for launching a tactical or strategic nuclear weapon, and they will deal with it accordingly. They'll take it out. They will destroy it. Now, one other fun fact about the F-16, for every 1 hour of flight time, combat air, it's down for 17 hours of maintenance. Think about that. That is, you know, so let's say you got five planes. If they've each flown 1 hour for that day, you know, it's going to be a full day before they can be used again. And that's assuming the maintenance is being done 24/7, you know, straight through. So this is a real problem. And plus, they can't have any kind of debris on the runway. That, you know, pebbles, rocks, leaves, you know, anything that's sucked into the engines can cause a catastrophic failure. So I don't know. Maybe at that point, the Russians will say, yeah, the best way to deal with it, they'll launch a device that unloads a bunch of marbles all over the
gravel.
Yeah.
Drop gravel in the air. I think you're right. There's a modified MiG that's also used for launching cruise missiles. That might be what, if I'm not mistaken, what Ukraine has been using so far when they have launched the Storm Shadow and Scalp missiles at various targets. But yeah, the F-16, definitely that can carry a nuclear-capable missile there. So that's a red line that a lot of Western politicians want to see crossed. They want that red line to be crossed, Larry. All these provocations, is this a strategy by the West to try Russia to react, to escalate?
Strategy requires a level of thinking and some intelligence. There's no thinking. There's no intelligence here. So these people say, oh, yeah, they're like a Hakeem Jeffries. I mean, what a bonehead he is, calling, oh, yeah, well, if Russia defeats Ukraine, we're going to have to put boots on the ground in Ukraine. Okay. Just go back and look at how long it took the United States to build up its military force in order to invade and defeat Iraq, which was a third-rate military with no air defense to speak of, with no air force to speak of, and with a lot of generals who were leading troops that had been bought off by the CIA to basically stay in their barracks. Took us 6 months of buildup to go in 2003. 6 months. And that, so it's called the TIP Fiddle, TPFL. It stands for, it's the process for alerting and deploying troops. The acronym within the Pentagon is called TIP Fiddle. And, you know, once they start that, they start that 6 months out and they start building up. Who on the Russian side is going to allow the Americans or any other NATO country to build up a military force that they know is going to come at Russia and not take preemptive steps to knock it out? So that's the first flaw in these, you know, armchair warriors in the Congress talking about deploying U.S. troops. Secondly, the first 2 years of the special military operation have demonstrated that the United States and all of its NATO allies, none of them are capable of mounting industrial production of armaments, vehicles, in the event of a sustained war. They've run out of Patriot missiles. They've run out of HIMARS. They're in the process of running out of ATACMS. They've run out of 155 millimeter shells, artillery shells. They've run out of the howitzer barrels that those shells pass through. And they're trying to scramble to produce more, but they're not able to even restore their own, have a surplus available to sustain operations, much less keep both Ukraine and Israel satisfied. You know, just, it's a little off topic, but it's related. You know, people are talking about, here's a Lloyd Austin. Yeah, we're getting tough with Israel. We're not sending them any more of these bombs. Well, okay, maybe they were making a real policy decision. Another thing to consider, we didn't have any to send. So they're taking advantage of the fact, hey, we've run out, so let's make it sound like we're being tough with Israel. And then once we get our production back up, we can send them some more.
I've not heard anybody say that, Larry, yet to this point. A lot of people have speculated as to what that announcement was about, because It certainly was going off the reservation in terms of U.S. policy up to that point. But you might actually be onto something, Larry. There's an actual production crisis with the supply chain.
Oh, absolutely. So I don't remember if it was retired Colonel Alexander Vyshinin, who writes at the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, or if it was this Substack guy, Simplicius the Thinker, one of them, pointed out that, and correctly so, that when the United States conducts these tabletop, you know, exercises, they communicate to see, you know, we're going to war game an attack on China, they're always limited to like 4 weeks. And at the end of the 4 weeks, you've got a decisive outcome. The reality is, as we've seen with the special military operation in Ukraine, it can last a lot longer than that. So then the question comes, do you have the wherewithal to sustain your force in the field and to sustain combat operations? And the fact is, the U.S. military is not. The Army's not. The Marine Corps is not. The Navy's not. The Air Force isn't. Because the U.S. military is not set up for an extended peer-to-peer combat. It's set up for, you know, the quickie, the wham-bam, thank you, man kind of scenario.
So, shock and awe. Shock and awe.
Yeah, shock and awe. Boy, we're going to shock. And we saw how that worked out in Iraq. Yeah, we eventually got the thing quelled, you know, the initial opposition from the Iraqi army settled in 3 to 4 weeks. There wasn't much there to start with. But then, boom, comes the insurgency, and it took us, 12 years to try to get that under control? So
So the picture you're painting here, Larry, is a disturbing one. It's that everything that the entire U.S. military and industrial complex, the command structure, the whole organization is working off, Windows 97, basically.
Yes.
It's fighting wars that aren't fought that way anymore. But that our whole system, including the lobbyists for the defense industry, all the boondoggle projects, they're carrying all this baggage from the 20th century, basically. Is that the state of affairs?
Yeah. We're basically, well, we pretend that we've got all this. We do. We have very sophisticated weaponry. I mean, I'll give you another example. The M1 Abrams tank got this turbine engine. Man, it's fast. If you're on a racetrack, for every 1 hour of combat operations, it has to go back in the shop for 8 hours of maintenance. Now, imagine that you live in Washington, D.C., and you want to drive to Miami, Florida. That's about a 17-hour trip, all right? And imagine you had the kind of car that for every hour you drove it, you had to stop and get it repaired for 8 hours. So it would only driving take you maybe 3 weeks to get there, 2 weeks. That's the kind of situation we're facing. But that's with the military. In a combat environment, you don't have the luxury of saying, hey, guys, time out. We need to go back and plug our electric vehicle in to get a recharge so we can continue the fight. I mean, it's that insane. So what we have spent literally tens of, trillions of dollars over the years on defense. And we've got a turkey. We've got this Lamborghini with no tires. So it's just sitting on blocks. Good to look at, pretty impressive. Oh man, that's got great lines. But when it comes time to actually operate in the combat theater, forget about it. You know, our aircraft carriers, that $13 billion a pop now, can be taken out with a $500,000 hypersonic missile that China has and Russia has. We don't have them. We haven't been able to produce them yet, despite all of our glorified self-professed technological expertise. So that's what I'm saying. All of these members of Congress talking about, yeah, we need to go, we're going to show them, we're going to express our military might. I go, really? How are we doing it with those Houthis? Huh? We've been locked, we've had Operation Prosperity Guardian launched since the first week of December. Well, we're coming to the middle of May now. And after, you know, we're into the sixth month of this, and the Houthis, sandal-wearing, backwards, uneducated, you know, tribal Muslims, have still got the Red Sea shut down, and we can't get it open, and we can't stop the Houthis. So we think we're going to go stop the Russians or the Iranians or the Chinese? Whatever we're drinking, we need to stop. Whatever hallucinogenic we're ingesting, we need to stop, because it's out of touch with reality.
Yeah, and it's also very, very expensive, and it's not getting any cheaper year in, year out, because the budgets are just going up, being inflated by inflation as well in the United States, higher than Venezuela at the moment in terms of inflation rates. Imagine that. Economists are scratching their heads. But I'm with Larry Johnson, former CIA operative, also a military analyst. Larry, if you're able to stay with us on the other side, I want to read you something from the Russian nuclear doctrine and get your reaction to it. But we're here and we're talking about a very important issue, ladies and gentlemen. There is real escalation happening between NATO and Russia. The pitch is Ukraine. That's where they're fighting this proxy battle, but things are getting much more serious. And if we're not able to act soon enough, this could actually spin out of control. We'll talk about that on the other side. I'm Patrick Henningsen. This is TNT, Today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate mouth.
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats.
It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom.
Reaching residential areas by...
And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way?
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
Hi, I'm Abel.
I often forget to mention that he's an amputee because Abel will try any activity he can.
My arm helps me with basically everything.
He doesn't see what he can't do, he sees what he can do.
Yeah, okay. This is helping.
The War Amps has just given him the ability to do all the activities every kid can do.
When you donate to the War Amps, you help kids like me. Thank you!
With a compelling perspective on global politics, this is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We're in the final segment, the final hour of this live broadcast here on Wednesday, TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. Very pleased to be joined right now with Larry Johnson. He is a military analyst, a former CIA operative, and really a great geopolitical analyst, a voice of sanity in these crazy times. Larry, when we're talking about insane scenarios, nothing gets more crazy than the mutually assured destruction world that we all grew up in during the Cold War era. I'm not sure if the younger generation are as au fait with all of that, but I want to read you something, Larry, which was actually signed by Vladimir Putin in July 2020. This is the Russia nuclear doctrine, the updated decree. Moscow's nuclear arsenal is intended to deter external aggression against Russia. And I quote, it is defensive in nature, this is English translation, aimed at maintaining the potential of nuclear forces at a level sufficient to ensure nuclear deterrence and guarantees the protection of the sovereignty of the territorial integrity of the state, deterring a potential enemy from aggression against the Russian Federation and or its allies, and in the event of a military conflict, preventing the escalation of hostilities and their cessation on terms acceptable to the Russian Federation and or its allies. Russia views nuclear weapons solely as a means of deterrence and considers their use an extreme and forced measure. So considering all that, Larry, and Russia's saying, we're doing snap drills now this week. I mean, it is serious if you measure it against their doctrine, which they say this is an extreme situation. How extreme is this situation?
Well, it hasn't gotten to, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd say we're about a 6 or 7. If we're at 9 going on to 10, then yeah, you know, they would be likely to use tactical nukes at that point. I think they're going to be able to deal with the situation with conventional missiles alone. If the West is foolish enough to step up and encourage more attacks on Russian territory and Russian assets in what was Russian territory prior to the start of the special military operation in 2022. But the West makes the mistake of not taking Vladimir Putin and the Russians seriously. And, you know, as long as we continue that, we're going to continue to run into these kinds of problems where we misestimate and mistakenly estimate what the Russians will or will not do.
And so they're very clear in this. They say even conventional weapons, using them against the Russian Federation, that's deemed as a credible threat inside, you know, used against Russian territory in the Russian Federation. So this also kind of brings in the Donbass, Larry, because these new regions, as they're called in Russia, Zaporizhia, Kherson, Crimea, Donetsk, Lugansk, Russia does regard these as part of the Russian Federation as well. The West doesn't, though, and that's a bit of a problem. And it seems like there's a lot of pushing and prodding, a lot of provocations, especially Crimea, Donetsk City as well. And is Russia going to call their bluff? Is that what's happening now?
Yeah, that started. You know, the other thing that's going on here, though, that is, it's a legacy of when the United States withdrew from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And there was also, there's been the announcement early under the Bush administration back, you know, 2000, actually the first Bush administration in 91, about withdrawing tactical nuclear forces from deployment. But what you've seen over the last couple of years is the United States now threatening to move, and in fact has put in place the Aegis missile system that used to be as a air defense system on a ship, but it's also capable of launching a nuclear-capable missile from Poland and from Romania towards Russia. So that's gone into effect. And then you've had the Biden administration openly talking about putting nuclear weapons in Poland and up in the Baltic countries and in Finland. And, you know, if the United States goes that route, I think you're going to see some really strong reaction from Russia. They're not going to let themselves be put in the position that the Soviets tried to put us in back at the Cuban Missile Crisis. They're not going to let those nuclear warheads and missiles be on their doorstep where they will only have 5 minutes to react, if that.
You mentioned the INF, Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, also the ABM, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. This is a very important one for Europe because of the proximity of these countries. Everybody's so close together. And that was a way of kind of under that kind of broader mutually assured destruction kind of framework. You had this piece like the ABM treaty, which kind of was it guaranteed a stalemate, basically, so that it was insane for either side to try it. So, but that was an agreement that stood for a long time. But that was another one that's gone out the window, Larry, with the others. So there's nothing now.
Yeah, so the go back to the ABM treaty. That was the first one that the United States walked away from. That was either 2001, 2002. George W. Bush decided, no, we want to be free to build up our own missile defenses, and so they just basically told the Russians, "Screw off. We're no longer going to abide by this agreement." And the Russians had encouraged the United States to stick with it. The United States said no, so the Russians go, "Okay." So what's happened in the interim period over the last 22 years, and that's 22 years at least, Russia has built up the most robust, technically sophisticated anti-ballistic missile system in the world, far outpacing anything the United States or any other Western nation has to offer. So Russia took advantage of it and said, okay, we're going to do it. Similarly, with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty. So that was designed to eliminate all ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles that, you know, could range around 500 to 1,000 kilometers to get those off the battlefield. Well, who was it that walked away from that? Donald Trump. U.S. unilaterally suspended it because, oh, we don't think Russia's complying. Well, if you don't think Russia's complying, there were methods attached to that agreement that would have allowed some verification process. So instead, the United States walks away from it. So, you know, here's Russia now actively, aggressively producing a whole variety of missile rocket systems that are ground-launched and air-launched that range well over the 500, they go up to 5,000 kilometers or more. So, you know, the Russians, again, they were playing by the rules. And then when the Russ changed the rules, they said, okay, that's how you want to do it. Well, we'll play for it for our own good. And they've done so. And so each of these stupid steps by the West have disadvantaged the West. You know, we thought it was going to make it easier for us to cheat, but just the opposite has happened. We become weaker, not stronger.
There's a speech Putin made, I think it was not long ago, in February, actually, where he accused the United States and its allies of flirting with nuclear disaster. He said, quote, "Everything that they are thinking up now that they are scaring the world with It all really poses the threat of a conflict involving nuclear weapons and therefore the destruction of civilization. Don't they understand this? Now, every time he makes these speeches, Larry, he gets scoffed at by, you know, the Beltway punditry, just dismissed out of hand. Oh, what's he talking about? He can't be serious. We're not threatening annihilation here. We're just, you know, poking them on behalf of Ukraine, this fledgling democracy that needs our support. That's how it's framed in the West. Totally different interpretation here by Putin and Russia. And is this a dangerous gap here, potentially?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That scene from, what was it, the movie with Paul Newman, HUD. What we have here is a failure to communicate. But this is a self-inflicted failure to communicate. It's one, the United States is not listening. It's not listening to what the Russians are saying. You know, they've been saying all, you know, Putin warned back in 2007. Hey, if you bring NATO to our doorstep, if you bring it to Ukraine, we're going to view that as an existential threat, and we're going to take action to stop it. Not new. That's been out there for 17 years at least. And the West is basically, he didn't mean it. Well, guess what? We're finding out he absolutely did mean it. And he had the means, the word, and the ability to enforce it, to, you know, basically shove it down our throats. Because Ukraine is losing, and with it, NATO's losing. NATO's losing face, credibility, reputation. So, and yet the West continues to push and push and push. Like, oh yeah, we're gonna force this to a major battle. They're looking for a pretext to get involved. But again, they look for the pretext, but they're not capable of following up. I mean, it's akin to a guy in a wheelchair who is paraplegic, can only, you know, can't use his legs. And he's heckling somebody, challenging them to a foot race. And because he doesn't think they're going to do it, he's challenging them to a foot race. Well, the guy says, and you know, and he bets, I'll bet all my wealth on it. Okay. The guy comes over and says, okay, let's go. Well, right now? Yeah. Let's go do the race. Well, he can't get out of the wheelchair. He doesn't have the ability to make the race. That's exactly the situation that the United States and NATO are in. We talk a good game. Yeah, we've got some troops we can move around here and there. But in terms of putting them into a combat environment that's going to be up against a peer and sustain operations beyond 2 weeks, hell, the Brits would be lucky to survive 1 week. So this is, and Russia, by contrast, they understand exactly. You know, look, they fought throughout the winter. They didn't say, oh my God, it's cold outside. Let's stay home. Let's do a valley forge. Let's huddle around the fire. Maybe we can toast some marshmallows. They didn't do that. They continued operations day after day after day. Then came the rainy season, the Rasputitsa, which is supposedly designed that so much mud that it makes the roads and fields impassable. And one of the British tanks found out, yeah, it's pretty impassable. Drove out there, got stuck. I don't know if they ever did unstick it. You know, were able to extract it. And what did the Russians do? Russians kept fighting, kept making progress. And then, you know, they were conducting, I believe, a counteroffensive since the fall of Avdiivka January, February, that has been, you know, accelerating with each passing day. So that's what, and that acceleration has been enabled because they've built up their military now. I think it's close to the total number is now with active duty serving about 1.2, 1.3 million. That's three times what the United States has active duty. You know, United States claims that it can call on reserve forces and such to get up to 1.2 million. But the Russians, in terms of actual living, breathing soldiers in uniforms, carrying firearms, carrying out military missions, is now close to 1.2 million.
And they have an incredible logistical operation now built up around the Donbass. And I remember myself, even just, I was like, the amount of trucks going back and forth is just, you know, I don't know, thousands and thousands a day. So it's not like they're shorthanded there.
And look, if you got a, you know, the 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne, how are they going to get resupplied? They had to depend upon a bunch of airplanes flying across the Atlantic, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They can only carry limited amounts. Whereas Russia's fighting, it's a home team, baby. You know, they got their own hot dog vendors and beer sellers. They don't have to worry about outsourcing.
I almost think, Larry, it's like, you know, in politics is driven by sound bites and, you know, social media viral statements and so forth. They're sort of running their Western military operations like this. They celebrate when the Kerch Strait Bridge gets hit by, you know, some kind of an underwater drone or a terrorist attack, effectively. Right. Or they're plotting, patting each other on the back whenever these disruptive events happen. But like you said, Larry, they can't really follow it up with anything substantial. So it's almost as if the military affairs are a reflection of the political, the way they're running politics as well. I don't know if that's got a couple minutes left to give us your final thoughts on this situation.
Yeah, look, this stuff is all, it's easy to predict in my view, because it's all about addition, subtraction when you're looking at actual capabilities. But why the Western military analysts persist in their delusional fantasies, I don't know. But no matter what you want to believe, I'll draw a parallel. If anybody knows anything about the Philadelphia Philly baseball fans, they're an obnoxious group. They get up there, they fight, you know. And so several years ago, about 15, 20 years ago, somebody in the promotion department thought, hey, I got this great idea. We're going to give every fan that shows up that day a full wooden baseball bat. That's a good idea. Yeah, you're laughing because you know what happened. They beat the crap out of each other with it that day. So it's like the reverse. You're not giving the Ukrainians what they need to be able to do anything on the battlefield, which is men. It's not more HIMARS or ATACMS or Abrams or F-16s or guns. It's trained personnel. And you don't go to a store and buy those. You don't hire out Raytheon or General Dynamics. They can't make them. That's Ukraine's problem, and they're done.
Yeah, this is a tragedy that continues to unfold. Lastly, for the country of Ukraine, we can't forget that when we talk about this conflict. But Larry Johnson, former CIA operative, also military analyst, thank you very much for joining us on TNT Today's News Talk. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, Patrick, always good to be with you, my friend.
Great to have you. Great to have you. Big thank you as well to Freddie Ponton in the first hour. Thank you guys for joining us. Top of the hour news headlines coming up. State of the Nation after this with Hesher and Tim O'Shea. Take care, you guys. We've got a fantastic show booked tomorrow. I hope to see you guys there. Same time, same place. All the best.